presents the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Mike McPeak, and with me today is Jeff Sire.
Hello, everybody.
And Julie is, we had a scheduling conflict. Even with modern technology, sometimes it's kind of hard to get everyone together. So it's just going to be Jeff and me today, but somehow that seems appropriate because after the last couple of movies we've done, we decided we need a palate cleanser. So we decided to do Road Warrior, testosterone-pumped, you know, epic from 1981. And the IMDb blurb on this is the post-apocalyptic Australian wasteland. A cynical drifter agrees to help a small, gasoline-rich community escape from a band of bandits. And, yeah, that's pretty much the whole movie.
Yeah, sums it up.
Yeah, and, you know, and I was, as I usually do when I get ready for one of these things, I look at IMDb, and I look at the trivia, and I look at the quotes from there, and I realize that by the time you get done reading the quotes, you pretty much have read half the movie dialogue.
Fair enough.
Yeah, because this is not heavy on dialogue, and I think I read somewhere in the trivia that Mel Gibson only had 16 lines of dialogue. There was
really,
yeah, there wasn't a lot of soliloquies in here. It's just kind of like, yep, nope, you know, that kind of, your brief stuff, you know, I'll help you, or I forget what some of them were, but it wasn't a lot of dialogue, which was fine because I think in this movie it worked. I mean, this movie is more about the atmosphere, the conditions, the situation, and I don't know that a lot of dialogue would have helped it. I think just, you know, you set things up. You get the basis of it. They have their opening monologue that sets up, in case you haven't seen it. And just there is a little confusion here among some people. We in the United States, we call this Road Warrior. Apparently, in the rest of the world, they call it Mad Max 2.
It's called the Road Warrior in Canada as well. I'd never even heard of the name Mad Max 2. Like, I didn't. Yeah,
and I think the reason they did the Road Warrior was because Mad Max hadn't been out. They felt it hadn't been out long enough to establish it, and if they were to bring out Mad Max 2, there might be some confusion. So I think they went with the Road Warrior for American release or maybe North American release.
Well, and by my recollection, like, I don't think Mad Max was really – I think it was very limited release in North America. It says it made $100 million in the box office.
Well, in the trivia,
in the U.S. So
yeah, in the trivia here, it says renamed the Road Warrior for North American distribution because at the time the original Mad Max, which was released in '79, had only been released there on a limited basis. So Mad Max 2, the title for outside North America, could have confused viewers. So, and really, you didn't in the synopsis. They gave you basically the plot of Mad Max as I remember it. I do remember watching it, but man, that was a long time ago. But yeah, basically, he's a part of a paramilitary policing force or whatever, and his family gets killed, and thus the Road Warriors created, the lonesome guy wandering the highways seeking revenge or, you know, whatever. That's basically, you know, Mad Max. So you really didn't need to see it. The first movie to get what's going on here. The synopsis sums it up, you know, pretty succinctly. And then they just plunk him down in here. So, like I say, there was a little confusion over the naming because, you know, you can find either one interchangeably, Road Warrior or Mad Max 2. It's for the people living outside of North America, so they understand that we're not completely stupid over here, or we're not completely crazy. The rest of that's up for debate. But like I said, after the last few movies, we just wanted something that was, you know, different. So we thought, you know, this nice testosterone movie here. And, you know, like what we usually, you know, our shtick here is we talk about the tech. Well, you know, there's tech in here, but I think I summed it up as post-apocalyptic retro steampunk tech. I don't know that steampunk would be entirely right, but I don't know how to describe the improvised mishmash of stuff that they, you know.
Yeah.
cobbled together.
I don't think steampunk is entirely wrong, except for steampunk tends to be kind of old-fashioned-y for just the sake of nostalgia or looks.
Right.
Whereas this is old-fashioned-y, like the kludged together flamethrowers and stuff like that, and the swing that the crippled guy works in. It's just like for the sake of, this is the best we can do with the tech we have right now, sort of thing.
Well, yeah, I think it's kind of shorthand for, the post-apocalyptic. So they're cobbling things together by necessity. Something breaks. You can't find spare parts. You have to improvise and make do with what you have. Their spare parts isn't something, is kind of a rarity, kind of like, gasoline is there too. But, so you have to make do with whatever. And some of the stuff I think was, as we'd call it here in the Midwest, duct tape and baling wire kind of fixes. You make do with what you have. And then people band together because society, apparently has collapsed worldwide because, nuclear war, oil crisis, the Cold War apparently went hot or whatever. They didn't elaborate it on that a great deal, but it just basically society as we know it has collapsed. And what do people do when, the stuff that holds people together collapses? They break down into small roving bands and they do what they need to survive.
I find it weird that in Australia, where you have like this humongous interior desert that's surrounded, you have this kind of like a thin ridge of, habitable area on the coasts. And then in these apocalypse movies, in all of Mad Max series, the first thing that they do when things fall is, head to the desert. Like, that seems like the last place you'd want to go.
Well, it depends what you're fleeing and what you're escaping. Because if there was, nuclear war, they're going to target the population areas. So, yeah, you want to get away from them. And, in Australia, you either got the ocean or you got the desert. And I guess if you flee to the ocean, then you have Waterworld, which is an entirely different movie. But so you're trying to get yourself out of harm's way, basically. And so there, you're out in the desert. And if communication has collapsed, you're not sure when it's safe to go back. And, we never really got a timeline for this movie, but, although it wasn't mentioned somewhere in the trivia here that supposedly it was 13 years. I thought there was maybe a basic timeline, but it doesn't say how many years have elapsed since society has collapsed and when this movie, takes place.
Yeah. The whole event of what's happened are, it's all left kind of very vague. They just say, and Australia is it kind of preys on Australia's weird position in this, that it's a developed country, but whatever happens really is they're going to be impacted by it, but they're probably not going to be influencing the situation. Like at the time in the Cold War, if there had been a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, they would have eventually been impacted, by the devastation that was caused, but they really wouldn't have had any input into it. Whereas Canada and Europe, we're much more, directly involved just because of proximity, right? So Australia and New Zealand are kind of left in this situation of being developed countries, but, they're kind of almost like they're on the moon in some ways when you look at sci-fi, because they're
right.
They're just kind of on their own. What's the book where the nuclear sub goes to on the beach? Neville Shute's book On the Beach. That's kind of the plot, that there's been a nuclear war. There are these huge clouds of radioactivity that are swirling around the globe, and eventually they're going to hit Australia and New Zealand and wipe out everybody, and they're all just kind of waiting to die. And it's kind of like that.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, too, Australia and New Zealand, they're both in that kind of position where they're, they are developed, but they're not quite in the superpower league with, now Russia, at that time Soviet Union, the United States, Canada, England, most of Europe. They're the ones that you know, kind of the power, they hold the seats of power, and Australia and New Zealand sort of sit there on the sideline. I mean, they have input. It's not like they're completely ignored, but they're probably not going to be one of the first targets taken out unless there's like a nuclear base or something there. And I don't know. I sort of remember Australia having at different times being pretty reticent about not accepting nuclear bases or being drawn into this too much. So
yeah,
I think, you know, politically they're probably going to be a little bit safer than the rest of the world. So yeah, it does make sense just to set the movie there, because if, you know, the crap does hit the fan, their distribution of the crap will probably be less than other parts of the country. So but you know, that's for it to take place. And like I say, they do have that kind of the desert lends itself to this post-apocalyptic, you know, future that you're, you know, postulating, you know, winter, nuclear winter, you know, the environment's gone to heck, and just, you know, out there you have to really scrape to get by. So I think that's what they're trying to imply.
Yeah. And certainly the Australian outback's a pretty unforgiving place. And yeah, like it's, I don't know, it's at the same time a brutal place to set a movie, but it really is, has its own kind of beauty, right? Like,
The desert and the rocks and yeah, and all that stuff. And I think the other reason that they did this too, they were kind of going for the Western movie vibe.
Yeah.
With the, yeah. I think in some place in here, they kind of a nod to the movie Shane, which I don't quite remember, but the drifter comes into town, befriends a little kid, and, you know, ends up saving the community kind of against his, you know, will or whatever. It's not what he really right. wanted to do, but he kind of gets drawn into it. Yeah, so, I mean, there was a few nods, you know, like that, the lone drifter, the, you know, isolated town, or isolated community. So, you know, there was part of that that they were going for, too.
I didn't really understand why they didn't just stay and fight. Like, they're sitting on the one resource, and it struck me that, these guys are going through nitrous oxide and gasoline like crazy. They, you know, the gang can't seem to last too long, and like they don't seem to have any other sources of fuel. Like it just seemed like they should just wait it out, and they'd be the ones that'd be on top in no time.
Well, and you know, they didn't really elaborate on the community's history a whole lot, but you get the feeling that there'd been constant raiding parties, and they're isolated there, and you know, yeah, they have an abundant supply of oil that they can refine, but the problem is you can't eat or drink oil. There doesn't seem to be a lot of for them to survive on, water, food. I'm imagining that they have to trade to do that, and this band of marauders didn't seem too keen on trading. They just wanted stuff.
Well, except for, I'd agree with you, except for they never once said that they were running short on food or water.
No.
So it just, if that had been the issue, okay, yeah, I see that. But all they ever said was like, oh, we can't stay here forever. Like, well, why not?
Well, unless they, you know, and I guess that maybe I'm just inferring that because it didn't, you know, and I didn't like study their compound real close, but I didn't see gardens. I didn't see anything else.
Yeah. They did have chickens and pigs, I know that.
Yeah, and they were making sure to round them up before they left. They just didn't leave them, which then begs the question, what were the chicken and pigs eating? You do need a source of protein, and so, you know, meat is good for that. But they and things like pigs, especially, you can feed them garbage. So, you know, as far as a sustainable, you know, situation, you can, you know, the stuff that you don't eat, feed to the pigs, and you eat the pigs. You just have to, you know, make sure you cook the pigs good, because trichinosis is a thing with pigs that eat garbage, so make sure you cook the meat well. But, you know, so as far as trying to manage your resources, that all makes a certain amount of sense. But you have to have stuff to create garbage for the pigs to eat, and you just didn't see that.
But overall, I don't think we've actually said we both like this movie. This is a great movie.
Yeah. And like I say, after the last couple we had, this is a really great movie. Not the others were bad, but we just needed a break. But yeah, it's, again, not a lot of dialogue to get bogged down in. The situation is pretty simple. You don't have to overthink this. You can just sit back and watch the bodies fly, literally. Because I was reading here in the trivia, I think towards the end, in the final battle there, the one guy goes over the bars of his motorcycle. That wasn't exactly planned. The guy actually got hurt in there. I think he broke his leg. But they said, hey, let's keep it. So, you know, I just can't find it. Because there's a fair amount of trivia for this thing here. But and in someplace else, too, I think they said for the last scene where the tanker overturns, they told the stunt driver probably not to eat the night before, so just in case you have to go into surgery or if you get injured in this thing, you'll have an empty stomach, and so the anesthesia won't bother you so much. I don't think you could get away with that today. There would probably be all kinds of unions getting upset because you're warning, hey, you know, there may be an accident here. Just be ready for that. You know, it just kind of fits in with the rough and tumble, you know, attitude of the whole movie. And, you know, I never did look at the box office, but what did they spend I suppose to get the vehicles and stuff, but I don't know if they spent a ton of money on this.
I think I did see,
a budget of $2 million.
It cost $4.5 million Australian. So yeah.
Okay.
So,
according to this, it says the budget, IMDb says the budget was $2 million. And opening weekend, they made $2.5 million, and the gross is about $9 million. So, you know, because, and I'm trying not to say this to denigrate the Australian people, but there wasn't, outside of Mel Gibson, and even then he wasn't as big as he is going to be, you know, in future movies, but there was no real big name stars in here that we're familiar with. I think maybe they were, you know, the Australian. They were probably big in Australia, I'm going to guess. I don't know. But so you didn't have to pay a lot of high price people. Your biggest expense is just all the vehicles that was, you know, destroyed. And that camp that was blown up.
Yeah. Well, I bet that would cost a fair amount, like, unless it was just, you know, kind of scrap or something.
Well, yeah, again, so much stuff here. But I think they said they did build that that camp. And I think it was, up until that point anyway, it was credited as one of the biggest sets ever built in Australia. And then they blew it up. And there was also something about, because I think, don't they mine for opals and other gems down there in Australia?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so I think they had to go around and warn the miners that they were going to be setting off this explosion just to keep any, you know, from any mines that might be around there from collapsing. So, you know, so they did spend some money on the sets and, you know, and vehicles and stuff. But, you know, it looks more like, how do I say it? It had, you know, good production values, but it didn't look like a big budget. You know, if we were doing this today, there would have been a lot more of everything in there, crashes and, you know, stunts and this kind of stuff. And it was like, and they did some pretty good stunts in there.
Well, Mad Max Fury Road had a budget of $150 million. So,
wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is that, about 75 times as much, if I'm doing my math quick? Yeah. And I don't know, is it 75 times better?
Well, I have Scott Johnson would say yes.
Yeah, and I know, and Brian, is it Brian Brushwood? On the Cord Killers, it's their, no, maybe it is Scott Johnson on Film Psych. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. That he keeps bringing up, yeah, that's, you know, Yeah, that's his go-to movie for whatever they're comparing it to. So, yeah, I know that he, you know, certainly thinks a lot. And like I said, I haven't seen Fury Road yet, and I should just sit down sometime.
Oh,
there's
it's
lots
good.
Of movies. Okay. Yeah, that's what I keep hearing. And who played the female lead?
Charlize Theron.
Yeah, okay. I know she got a lot of props for playing somebody with, you know, a bad arm or whatever the deal was. But, yeah. It's, but, you know, I don't think that, even though this movie had a budget of $2 million, I don't think that detracts from it any. Because, I mean, we've watched some movies that had, you know, I think probably bigger budgets, and we're kind of looking at the special effects going, really? You guys couldn't have done any better? I think they I think they did pretty good for what they had to work with making this movie and doing the stunts.
Yeah, I think it's a – and also it's a product of its time, right? It's like 1981, so – it's, you know, you're not in an era of, like, the enormous movie budgets that we have now. And plus, it was this is essentially an indie film because it's made in Australia. So, yeah, like, I think it might not have a huge production budget, but I certainly think you're getting a lot for your, you know, a lot of value for your dollar in what they did spend.
Well, yeah, and, you know, by the way the film is set up, your outfits need to be worn and torn and used. So, I don't know, but there might – trying to find that kind of stuff could – use stuff might be kind of expensive too. And I did read in here somewhere that they were inspired by basically an S&M shop in one of the towns where the designer – their costumer lived, so she used that as inspiration. So, all right. Well, then I didn't really find an answer, but okay, I have this big Borderlands video game addiction, and I'm just wondering if Mad Max influenced, you know, when they were designing that game, or is this standard?
I bet it did. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at some of the characters in there and some of the rough and tumble and the, like, say, the kind of the S&M apparatuses, the masks and the chains and all this kind of stuff. I couldn't find anything that directly said it, but I would be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's a desert. It's, you know, you got all this kind of patchwork stuff, you know, post-apocalyptic stuff. So I'm just thinking that they had to be. But and what was the time between this movie and Fury Road? Was it like 15 years? 20 years?
Oh, like time in the movie or time?
Oh, I mean real time.
Real time. This came out in 81.
Right.
And then Fury Road came out. Oh, you mean between this and Beyond Thunderdome?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Beyond Thunderdome.
It was the next one, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about
that. So Beyond Thunderdome, when did that come out?
That must have been mid-80s.
Beyond Thunderdome came out in 85, so it was 4 years later.
Okay. All right, and then there must have been roughly, because when did Mad Max? That's like 3-4 years ago. So it must have been roughly 20-something years.
Fury Road came out in 2015, so there was 30 years.
30 years. Wow. Okay, so that's kind of quite a span in between these two movies. And I should probably just sit down and, you know, I've watched this one. I should go back and watch Mad Max and then watch Thunderdome and then watch the Fury Road. Because I'm assuming they continue on. Well, I mean, they have Mad Max. So I'm assuming it continues on with his story. And what is the story by the time you get to Fury Road?
What's the story of Fury Road?
Yeah, basically.
Max gets run off the road and captured by Immortan Joe and his crew. And he controls this underwater aquifer, and he's keeping women as breeding stock. And then Furiosa, whatever her name is. Anyways, this Charlize Theron character, she helps I think it's five of Immortan Joe's concubines escape.
It is
worth all the good things people say about it. It's a beautiful movie. The effects are great. The stunts are amazing, but the plot is we drove out, we changed our minds, we drove back. So, like, I have a bit of an argument with people that say that it should have won Best Picture of the Year. I don't even think it should have been nominated for Best Picture of the Year, because, like, well, you know, to me, a movie that's going to be Best Picture of the Year or even nominated for Picture of the Year should be, like, pretty much a 9 or a 10 in every category. And this was probably a 10 in every category except for plot, which was we drove out, we changed our minds, we drove back. So, and these people that say that, like, this is kind of like a Scott Johnson thing, because he goes on and on about it and like, oh, the world building. Well, the world building is, hey, here's some weird stuff that we're not going to explain. And then you just, you know, you're left to mull it over, and that's world building. I don't buy that at all. Like,
yeah,
they show you a collage of very just bizarre things that don't make a whole lot of sense. And if you're an artistic person, I guess your mind leans towards explaining how these things came to be. But to say that that's world building, that's a bunch of crap as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, I might have to just watch that because, yeah. I mean, well, except for the, you know, narrative at the beginning and the narrative at the end of the movie, which we find out was the feral kid that running around with him. He eventually goes on to become the leader. You know, inside the movie itself, in between the bookends there, you know, there wasn't a lot of world building. You don't understand why these people are there, where they came from. We don't, like you said, we don't even understand why it was important for them to leave. We're assuming. And I don't know if the movie would have necessarily been improved to explain why they needed to leave. Just run with the premise that they need to leave. That would have added more unnecessary dialogue and just, you know, lengthened the movie out. And I don't know if it would have changed, you know, the outcome. They just needed to leave. But yeah. Like I said, I didn't see a lot of world building in there. I mean, these marauders are just marauding. They just, I guess that's what marauders do. They run around and steal crap and harass people.
Yeah.
So, like I said, inside this movie, I didn't see a lot of, you know, world building. But I might just have to watch Fury Road just to see, you know, what you mean there.
If you contrast this with the books or the TV show The Expanse, those guys were meticulous in developing their backstory, not all of which makes it into the story.
Right.
But you get a sense that everything that's happening is that way for a reason, because it is. Even if they haven't told you what it is, those guys that wrote those books, they know how everything got the way it is. And if you sat down with them, they would explain it to you in detail. But because they've done so much back work, it has the sense of that kind of world building, that things aren't just – we didn't slap this stuff together for no reason. In this movie, you don't get any explanation for how these people came to be in charge of an oil refinery in the middle of the desert. And it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like, if they were just industrial workers, they wouldn't have kids with them. There's no real explanation. And they just don't even try. And they don't – there's no sense that there is a reason, right? Right.
Yeah. And like I said, there doesn't seem to be any reason.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said –
Not necessarily bad.
No.
It's just like, this is a fun movie.
Yeah.
And you take it as that.
Yep.
But, I don't know. When people go on and on about, oh, the world building that, you know, you're just left to do that. Like, okay, you know, I'll tell you the outline of a story. Then you make it up in your mind and you don't even need to see the movie. There's great world building if you just follow that through. Right.
Well, yeah. And, what was I going to say? It goes back to, you know, things we've said about a lot of these movies. You know, don't poke it too hard. Just kind of go with it. And like, in this case, yeah, there's a few things that if you want to take the time to kind of nerd out and go, what about this? What about that? What's their motivation? What's their, you know, whatever. Yeah, you can, you know, sit there and, you know, like I guess sometimes nerds are want to do and just tear things apart. But it wouldn't, I don't think, have made the movie any better to have. Yeah. Like I said, it's just those little niggling things off to the side that you kind of wonder about. But still, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the movie any.
But there are certainly there's other things like the movie Highlander is another good example. That's a when you look at it on the surface, you can say, oh, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But when you if you see the director's cut that has like 10 or 15, no, it's no more than that, maybe 15 or 20 extra minutes. Like, yeah, it makes a lot more sense. And these guys, like the people that wrote that, there's a lot of stuff there. And they obviously spent a lot of time thinking about the plot and how it would expand forward. And, you know, and so there to me, when you see a movie like that, when you pull at those threads, they're attached to things and you can actually suss out, you know, bits of them. And they do make more sense the more you think about it.
Well, yeah. And this movie, you know, I don't know for sure, but I don't know that there's like any book associated with it. The movie didn't come from a book. It may have been vice versa. Somebody may have written a book based on the movie. But then that's the problem. You know, you were talking about The Expanse and some other movies that take their source material is an already published book. It gets harder for them to try and to deal with loose threads because there will be people in the book, you know, and the problem is you got to take something that's written and turn it into something visual. And where in a book where you can take the time to explain things and be able to, you know, elaborate on them visually, some of those things are kind of hard to do. So for some of those things, you just kind of have to, as long as it's not a big gaping hole, you just kind of have to ignore it and roll with it. And same with this here, that, again, I don't know that having the backstory may have been interesting, but I don't know that it really would have changed the story or their motivations, because their motivation is just, we need to get out of here. And those guys want to kill us, and so we have to, you know, figure out some way to, you know, get around them.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So, you know, we like I said, we already, you know, we kind of touched on the, you know, the tech in here, and a lot of it is just, you know, I guess it's a masterpiece of recycling, or what they visualize as recycling, reuse, recycle, whatever. And, you know, they've cobbled together a lot of stuff. Like I say, you talked about the hoist for the and I guess I didn't notice that he was his legs didn't work. I just assumed he was sitting in there.
Well, if you remember at the end where they put him up in the truck and he's shooting at everybody, his legs catch fire and you can see then his legs are actually tied together, I think.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah. So you can see like, yeah, he is, I don't know. He's unable to walk. His legs don't seem to function. So,
well, I should maybe go back and look at it a little closer too, because they were talking about certain goofs in the movie where you could see things like when I think the door is ripped off the truck at the end. If you look, there's supposed to be a crew member laying on the floor of the truck in there or something.
Oh, really?
You know, things like that. So, you know, they're in, not that it takes away from the movie, there you may see, you know, a compromise on production values, but and I think there's a few other things like that. There's a couple, and I don't remember what they are right offhand, where crew members were in shots or something like that. And every movie is going to have goofs of, you know, some sort, but and I always say that when you notice those kind of goofs, you're really watching the movie. And I guess I don't watch a movie that closely, but I might have to go back and see, because like I said, I saw the guy there and I just assumed he was just somebody that, you know, that was his shtick. He just, you know, rode around in the thing, but okay.
Oh, I never even noticed it.
Yeah. Well, I saw him in his little cradle that he had there, but
I thought you were talking about the goof of the crew guy lying on the floor of the truck.
No, I never saw that either. Like I say, those kind of things I don't. But like I say, it was the trivia that pointed that out. And there was a fair amount of goofs, but, you know, $2 million, I think you get certain leeway. For, you know, those kind of things. And then another piece of tech in there was the, and I'm not really too familiar with it, but the gyrocopter. I guess that's actually a thing. A natural functioning thing in the real world. I thought maybe it's just an ultralight and they were, but I guess it did actually, I mean, you saw it flying there.
Yeah.
And from what they said, I guess that was one of the goofs that they talked about in there, is that that thing wouldn't actually be able to hover. It relies upon forward movement,
right,
to keep itself airborne. So, yeah, it isn't exactly a helicopter like one would think it is, but that was that was integral, to the story, because a little air support never hurt, anybody.
True.
Yeah, but now the flip side of that, though, is that you're also a sitting duck up there, too, if they can manage to shoot at you, so, it's pluses and minuses, but yeah, it did, help the story along. But yeah, certainly that was tech that was in there. I'm trying to remember, the cobbled together trucks. I mean, the good old Mack truck, beefed up and reinforced. A lot of these cars, looks like a lot of them were, well, like the Marauder cars were something that they just pieced together. The one that the camp leader was driving at the end there, that was, certainly not a production car or something that...
Yeah, that looked just like a total dune buggy or something.
Yeah, with skin over it or something like that. And then you can get pretty imaginative then, because then you're not dealing with stock cars. You can just whip up whatever kind of vehicle you want on for that.
Yeah.
The tech itself really, the tech was there. It was integral to the movie, but you didn't see much of it. Just the whole oil refining, oil production refining, that's, tech that's kind of, that's why these people are here. So that's kind of central to the movie. But
yeah, but that wasn't, there was nothing there that looked high tech science fiction at all. Like that was strictly, it was if the forward technology progress stopped in 1979 or 1980, whenever this was filmed, right?
Right.
That's when the events that led to the decline of society happened, and that there was no science fiction per se in this.
As far as sci-fi tech, nothing groundbreaking, there was still tech in here, but not like the sci-fi tech that we're used to talking about. And there was one thing in there that it's not tech, but I liked it just because the dog that he had there at the beginning of the movie, or through, two-thirds of the movie, whatever it was, before those a-holes shot him. I like that, because that was an Australian Blue Heeler. We had one on the farm out there, good old Rover. And that's not, at that time, that wasn't a dog that was really prevalent over here. But I saw him, and I go, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I know what kind of dog that is. And so, I liked, and just that was his companion, and, helped him a lot. And then he was replaced by the feral kid. So apparently Mad Max always has to have a sidekick of some sort or another.
Yeah. Well, that dog is the one tie-over other than Max to the first movie, right? He has that dog in the first movie.
Okay. It's been so long since I watched that. And, looking at the trivia, this was a dog that was rescued from a kill shelter. I think I don't know if it was a matter of hours or days before, and they went in there and they saw him and thought it would be good for the movie. And so they trained him. And the only thing was that a lot of the loud noises scared and frightened him. So they had to give him earplugs for some of those scenes. Yeah. But otherwise, I liked him. I have a soft spot for dogs anyways. Reach over and pet my beagle over here. She's in my co-pilot chair over here listening to me drone on and on. But yeah, so I got a soft spot for dogs. So like I say, that isn't tech, but every hero has to have his companion. In this case, it happens to be a dog. So
sure.
Well, I think we're kind of to that point. We asked the usual question: was there any tech in there that that you would want?
I don't think so. You mean, there was nothing there that I thought, oh boy, that'd be fun. Yeah, I was thinking about that. And the only thing I thought, maybe a gyro, whatever they called that thing, the little mini helicopter, but I don't think I'd even want that. Well, it looked like a death trap.
Well, most of the stuff looked like a death trap if you're going to do that. Yeah. Most of the stuff was, you know, I don't know if it would pass safety inspections or not, especially like when you're tied to the front.
I don't think there was one vehicle in that whole movie that would pass a safety inspection.
Oh, no, I don't think so. Especially like, say, when someone requires you to be tied onto the top or you got like spikes protruding that could impale lots of things. So... I thought maybe you would have, and I wasn't, like I said, looking that close, but I know you're a motorcycle dude, and was there motorcycles in here, or was it more
for you? Oh, yeah, there was motorcycles, yeah.
Okay, there wasn't any of those that grabbed your attention then?
Well, there was, they had a CB750, and I actually used to have one of those, but, I have a better one now, so I wouldn't need that.
Okay, there you go.
Although some of those bikes, you could make a lot of money if you had them in mint condition today. Well, not huge amounts of money, but they're worth something now. Like the CB750s, a lot of people take those and make them into cafe racers, and there's a demand for them anyway.
Okay. And the and something else was that the Interceptor that Mad Max drove, one of them was, I think, destroyed in the movie, but there was another one, and they were going to scrap that. Well, then somebody took it and hung on to it, and I guess that's become rather valuable.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
Because it was used in the movie. And there wasn't, and that was another thing, just Australian cars are different. And that was the first time I saw this movie, I wasn't aware that it was filmed in Australia. And I'm going, why are they driving on the wrong side of the car? Why are they sitting on the wrong side? So it wasn't 81 when I saw it. I saw it on TV at some point, so probably mid-80s. Why are they sitting on the wrong side? It confused me. You know, me, the American, I get baffled by such things. but, you know, as far as me for tech, there wasn't really anything. Although, like I say, some of their mechanical flights of fancy were rather intriguing. I don't know if I'd want to have one or not, but for me, again, I'm just going to go back. I want the dog. I like the dog. Give me the. It's not tech, but give me the dog. So, okay. So I guess our final thoughts is good movie, worth the watch.
I would say if you're a fan of sci-fi fantasy in general, this is a must-see. If you're a fan of post-apocalypse movies, this would be probably be in your top five, but yeah, I would say if you're a fan of this podcast and you haven't watched this, you should go out and see it right away and not tell anybody you waited so long to see it, because this is a classic.
And it's buried, and there's a lot of trivia I can't keep track of, but it did make the list of some magazine's top 100 movies or sci-fi movies. I forget what the distinction was.
While we were recording, I did look up like the top 100 heroes of all time, and I thought Max Rockatansky would be on it, but I had to look through several lists before I could find one with him on it, and it was a list of to 50 top science fiction heroes or something like that, and I thought he would be higher, because like he's one of these guys that is not necessarily a hero. He's kind of a, I guess it depends on how you look at it. Cause like he really is a very reluctant hero.
Right.
Kind of gets dragged into it.
And then I was looking here, I think, it was that, the character Wes in the movie, the guy with the mohawk,
right.
He made the list of, I forget whose list, but and I forget how long the list was, but he made the list of top movie villains.
Villains, yes.
Because he was, as far as villains go, he was pretty villainy.
It's kind of funny that he outshines Humongous, right?
Yeah.
Who's the main bad guy.
He's the mad dog in this case, I guess, because they literally had him chained up like you would some junkyard dog, and, you know, you let him off the chain, let him wreak his mayhem. Lord Humongous was more the, I guess, the guy you want in charge of, you know, your community, because he's at least somewhat level-headed, if sort of deranged. I mean, you have to be deranged to be roving around killing people and stealing stuff. But he has more of the mentality of managing people, whereas Mad Dog's idea of managing is just kill them. You know, it's a little bloodthirsty, but... so, yeah, good movie. Go watch it. So that wraps up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com or follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. Or if you have ideas or comments, please send them to greetings at scifitechtalk.com. And reviews on iTunes are always welcome. So, Jeff, where can people find you?
People can follow me on Twitter at Bronco Sire. That's S-Y-E-R.
And if you want to find out more about me or what I have to say, you can follow me on Twitter at DSC Chipman, or I have an about.me page at about.me/Mike McPeak. That's M-C-P-E-E-K. Or if you want to listen to the other podcasts I do, go check me out at geekiestshowever.com and see what we're discussing this week. Next episode, we'll be covering the 2012 book, 2312. The year is 2312. Scientific and technological advances have opened gateways to an extraordinary future. Earth is no longer humanity's only home. New habitats have been created throughout the solar system on moons, planets, and in between. But in the year 2312, a sequence of events will force humanity to confront its past, its present, and its future. That's it for this show. We'll see you in the future. Where do you matter? Where do you matter? It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.